Welcome to A World of Fragile Truths, a podcast where we unpack the latest evidence for security and rule of law, which show the assumptions under this sector's work are often fragile. I'm Christian Kuitert from the knowledge platform Security and Rule of Law, and today's latest evidence comes from my guest Nupur Prakash from the International Development Law Organization, ITLO. In her recent report, Nupur describes a need for better representation of women and girls at the decision-making tables on climate change policies and seriously taking gender differences into account when talking about the consequences of climate change. Jelen Paklarin from the Women's Legal and Human Rights Bureau is also here with us, as she puts many of these recommendations into practice in her Philippine context, where she supports women's legal rights around natural disasters. Hi, Nupur, Jelen.
Hi, Christian. Happy to be here.
Yeah, happy to have you. To start maybe then with you as writer of the report, Nupur, can you tell us a bit more about yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Christian. So my name is Nupur Prakash. I work as the General Law Analyst at the International Development Law Organization. IDLO is an intergovernmental organization that is exclusively devoted to promoting the rule of law. I am a qualified lawyer from India, with a background in international criminal law, as well as the rule of law development sectors. Some of the areas that I have been working in over the past few years include combating gender-based violence against women and girls, advancing elimination of discriminatory laws against women and girls, working towards increasing and strengthening women's leadership and participation in the justice sector, and most recently, working towards using the rule of law as an enabler to achieve feminist climate action.
Yeah, and so a rich history in feminist action, let's say. And Jelen, you're calling all the way from the Philippines. What's your history with feminist climate action?
I'm Jelen Paklarin. I'm the executive director of the Women's Legal and Human Rights Bureau. WLB is a feminist legal non-government organization based in the Philippines. Basically, what we do is we use the law to transform the inequalities faced by women and girls in our societies. And in particular, we also cater to the issues of women who are victims and survivors of disaster. So I'm a full-time NGO development worker. I'm also an educator, particularly focusing on feminism and gender studies, feminist legal theories. So when I get bored doing development work, I also do part-time teaching.
Oh, look at that. Very multifaceted. Now, Nupur, transformative climate action based on feminist rule of law approach. Can you explain to me what I just said?
Sure. So you'll see that for more than two decades, global policy discourse on climate change has largely focused on technical goals like the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and carbon emissions, but has largely ignored the broader landscape of structural inequalities that have actually contributed to the climate crisis, and has not acknowledged the role that several actors can play towards remedying it. At the same time, we see that women and girls, and especially rural women, indigenous women, and women from the global south, have been at the forefront of climate justice and possess diverse skills.
And what do you mean with climate justice?
What I mean by climate justice is working at community levels to ensure that, for example, women's environmental rights defenders are able to voice their agency and speak about women's access to land, natural resources. We look at it from a broad spectrum. So we look at environmental rights and how to claim them, and also to be able to participate and effectively contribute to climate decision making, but also working towards strengthening regulatory and legal frameworks that can advance such feminist climate action at all levels. So the community, national, international levels, and then a huge...
What kind of regulatory framework? Sorry, I'm trying to get the jargon in place for our listeners here.
Okay, regulatory frameworks means, you know, laws. This goes across, because gender and climate both are cross-cutting issues. So this grows across environmental rights, inheritance rights, you know, laws on gender-based violence. How are response mechanisms designed? Yeah. Then what is the discussions at the international levels on, you know, women's human rights? And so this is just a brief, let's say, intro to what this means. But, you know, as Jelen said the other day, it's a continuum. And so it really, it's all aspects of women's lives that are governed by laws are very important in this context, because they all perpetuate discrimination.
And if you hear that, Jelen, so claiming rights, but also working on, let's say, changing those regulatory frameworks, would you say that you're indeed also working on transformative feminist rule of law approach?
Invisibility of women and women's experiences are always one of the challenges that they face, no? And it's because women's experiences are non-quantifiable, whether it's in terms of inequalities, whether it's brought about by not being able to access land, or not being able to get livelihood programs as a result of disaster. Women are usually not counted or invisible in the whole picture. And that's the reason why we have to look at those frameworks to ensure that those experiences are reflected in the law and address issues of women.
And what part within that wide spectrum are you working on with your organization?
We work at the level on transforming policy at the local level. So we always connect women's experiences and challenges on the ground and how these experiences of women can be used to challenge the law or policy at the local level. We also try to also empower them to tap their agencies so that they can participate meaningfully in bodies at the local level.
And Nupur, is this feminist approach very different from if you would, for example, advocate for more youth action maybe in climate change issues or other maybe underrepresented or marginalized groups? Why, for example, not take intersectionality as a starting point?
Christian, firstly, I want to thank Jelen for the point she made, because last year, the launch of the Global Generation Equality Forum highlighted that we need better data, we need more evidence to identify, you know, women's contributions, to understand women's vulnerability. And I think your question around intersectionality is very important here. You'll see in our research that we have advocated that every climate action, initiative needs to adopt an intersectional approach. This is because climate affects different groups of people and different groups of women differently. And there is a matrix of oppression which helps you understand how age, gender, ethnicity, nationality, all of that interplays, the different social economic factors in one's ability to affect climate action, but also it defines how climate change impacts them.
And Jelen, do you have examples then of what happens if we don't take action?
One of the most familiar scenario is the typhoon, the result or the impact of Typhoon Haiyan. I would just like to take into consideration that women already experienced inequalities prior to the typhoon. The aftermath of the typhoon exacerbated the other forms of inequalities to women. So, for example, there were some researches that also highlighted the increase of gender-based violence during the time of typhoon or after typhoon. No? Trafficking of women and girls are very much pervasive, and then also domestic violence. And given that there are no available legal remedies, because when Typhoon Haiyan happened in the Philippines, even the village heads and government structures went down. So there were no place to get or access legal remedies. So usually women will prefer not to go or report the case because they will prioritize more economic concerns rather than domestic concerns. No? That's how they look at it.
And as Jelen highlighted, gender-based violence is a huge, huge issue as it is in the women's rights context. And then in times of crisis and emergency, whether it's, COVID-19 or the climate crisis or extreme weather events, there is enough evidence that talks about that that violence against women is on the rise. And most recently, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the foremost body of assessing climate change, came out very strongly in their latest report, also talking about the fact that, you know, the evidence is clear on the fact that the disproportionate impact on women as a result of climate change is very, very high, and that this needs to be taken into consideration. GBV in these contexts are also often used as a means and tools to reinforce existing inequalities and, you know, unequal power dynamics. So it further makes it more difficult to access, you know, rights to land, natural resources, and, you know, engage in decision-making spheres.
Thanks, Nupur, and also for referring to some recent evidence again, which is very important, of course, for this podcast. So maybe the last question before we go into a quick break. Many of our listeners work at national or international NGOs, and more women at the negotiation table and decision-making table, or take the differences per gender into account when talking about the impact of climate change. Those are okay to picture, right? But what when we're talking about strengthening regulatory frameworks and capacity, do you have examples of that?
So for example, we're actually piloting this approach where we're assessing climate regulatory frameworks from a legal and gender perspective, so that we are able to work with government institutions into building the capacity on writing gender responsive climate laws. You know, often what happens is that laws that look gender neutral in practice actually, you know, end up discriminating against women, because again, we have to remember
the law, for example.
For example, land rights, you know, for example, the fact that women, there's data that shows that women in the Global South, about 43% of them work on, you know, land, but only 15% have actually rights to that land. And that results is in the fact that when there is a climate crisis, when there are issues around, you know, water scarcity, these women actually don't have the ability to contribute to the decision making in the communities. And it's very disempowering for them, because their daily life actually contributes to this work. But in reality, they're unable to contribute to the decision making. And there is enough evidence that shows that women in at grassroots levels are leading innovative solutions in adaptation and mitigation.
All right. Well, after the short break, we'll dive into some more examples and ways to turn this around. But first, our listeners share their fragile truths in this sector.
Donor countries often say that they look for mechanisms of international cooperation in which all actors can win and benefit from the process. Yet, this narrative of win-win mechanisms may well be a fragile truth. Donor and target countries often have divergent interests and priorities. For instance, the renegotiation of a social contract, even when it leads to a more just and inclusive one, often entails periods of confusion and instability. These periods are often not liked by donor countries, who tend to prefer quick solutions that deliver stability, even though they are less transformative for society. Donor countries need to take a hard look at how they can balance their own priorities with those of the countries they seek to help. These are not always easy to reconcile, and being aware of this may be a first good step towards finding the right balance.
Thank you for sending in those fragile truths. If you have an idea, send a voice note of your fragile truth to the KPSRL address in the description. Jelen, can you tell us a bit more about feminist climate action in the Philippines more broadly, as we didn't treat that region in our podcast yet? Be curious to hear more.
In relation to the after the typhoon Haiyan, there were actually a lot of organizing that happened at the community level. So when most of the humanitarian networks left the Philippines, some of the women's organizations continue. And some of them even continue to engage local governments in demanding accountability, like, for example, coming up with an ordinance relating to a disaster risk reduction management policy, ensuring, let's say, participation of women at the municipal level. I remember there was this story in the central part of the Philippines where the women, they used the cave as their protection during the typhoon Haiyan, no? from the big waves, no? And therefore they tried to provide stairs so that if in case there will be a storm surge again, no, happening in the area, they can make use of that cave because the cave was like serve as a protection, no, for the community. On the other hand, in another part in the Philippines where we are also working with, we are actually trying to help them to come up with an eco-ethnotourism program for the community, for the indigenous peoples. We are in the process of being able to preserve the place because it's an indigenous, it's part of the ancestral land of the indigenous people, but at the same time also hoping to also get some earnings or livelihood program along with the indigenous people. So those are some actions that communities are doing to protect, to continue protect and preserve the environment, but also at the same time doing some policy reforms.
Right. And are any of Nupur's recommendations especially relevant for your context?
Yes, I think one is on the continuing inclusion of women, making women visible through data. We always mention that women are not included, women's stories are not included in the data. So how can we transform those stories and narratives as part of the data? So that's one. And then second, we have to continue reforming some of the laws that continue to promote inequalities to women and girls by ensuring their full participation, that this participation will translate to access opportunities.
Yeah. Which Philippine laws are especially difficult in this case?
We have the so-called Magna Carta of Women, which actually, like, it serves as a list, no, of the rights of women and girl children in the Philippines. Unfortunately, in the last reporting of the Philippines to the CEDAW, or the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the policy or the law is yet to be achieved, no? Because there are a lot of mechanisms put in place to ensure participation of women, but until now, it's still not being implemented in full, no, by the Philippine government.
And Nupur, do you recognize a lot of these actions, or have you actually seen very different also types of actions that you want to highlight here?
You know, Jalen's point is really goes to the heart of the matter. That women's inclusion and women's effective participation is really crucial. And I think, so women have a right to effectively participate and contribute to climate action as equal rights holders and agents of change. It is a human right that has been found, you know, in the CEDAW Convention and most recently also in the international climate agreements. So I also want to make sure that when we talk about women's rights in the climate change context, we don't come across as trying to make a business case on why they should be included. Because first and foremost, it's a human right. And then when we go into evidence, there is clear evidence that suggests that you know, adaptation and mitigation measures that disregard women's agency, then they result in unsustainable solutions to climate action.
What is the best example of feminist climate actions that you came across in your research, something that had a huge impact?
Oh, this is difficult. let me think, because it's really hard to, you know, say what's the best impact, because if you see the recommendations of the report, it's not like implementing one recommendation is what's going to achieve feminist climate action. It's the broad spectrum of gender inequality that needs to be tackled, right? And so all the 7 recommendations of the report contribute to towards creating a more equal world for women and girls, so that they are at par with men in contributing to climate action. So, you know, if we are working on gender-based violence and we're working on protecting survivors of gender-based violence, that alone is not enough. We also have to work with communities in the household, outside the household, to change social norms. We also have to work with community leaders, with justice systems to make justice accessible. Yeah. It's a more holistic approach that's required to achieve feminist climate action.
The interviewer always wants those easy, snappy answers, but they are unfortunately not there. And your point of that inclusion is simply a right is obviously well taken. Well, we're closing to the end. So is there something else that we might have missed still in the paper, Nupur, or something that you'd like to stress even more?
I think a couple of things, Christian. We've not touched about the issue of prevailing food insecurity, mm-hmm. And I think it's very important to highlight the fact that women and girls constitute majority of the food insecure people worldwide, and this is further exacerbated in times of crisis. And then the other point, which is extremely important, is about financing. So if you look at climate change financing, only 3% of it from bilateral donors actually specifically aim at advancing gender equality. And there is enough evidence to suggest that this is not sustainable and it's not going to produce the results that we hope for.
Do you, Jelen, have any reflections on that point on food insecurity or other observations about these conversations, points that you still want to get across?
Yeah, I think my last point would be when we talk about climate issues, women usually bear the brunt, and therefore women must be included, and not just as impacts, because usually when they refer to women, it's always the impacts to women. Women are actually part of the solutions, and being part of the solution would mean women being included in the discussion, and women's stories should be included in the discussion. I always remember one line that usually indigenous women would always say in the Philippines, that environment is their life. And it's like, and without environment, they would not be able to continue their lives. Indigenous peoples and those who are fighting for environment are the one more exposed or more vulnerable to those challenges and problems. And we need to consider also their needs.
Well, there you have it. Also, on behalf of our listeners, thank you so much for coming here. And our listeners, as always, stay vigilant for the fragile truths in your work. This was the last episode of this second season, so we'll see you in the next one.
Great. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, and bye.